Welcome to the second hour's reading of the Midland Reporter-Telegram and the Odessa American. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand at recordinglibrary.org.
Man accused of molesting two girls. A 32-year-old Odessa man was arrested Monday on a warrant issued after two girls alleged he touched them inappropriately last May. According to an Ector County Sheriff's Office report, two sisters, 13 and 12, told their mother and a forensic interviewer, Samuel Velasquez Vasquez, had molested them on multiple occasions. Vasquez was booked into the Ector County Jail Tuesday on suspicion of indecency with a child. He's being held on a $50,000 surety bond and an Immigration and Customs Enforcement hold. Rural Texans' internet providers worry that Fed's broadband expansion plan will have a painfully slow rollout. Texas is poised to receive more than $3.3 billion in federal money to fund a dramatic expansion of broadband, a historic investment in a state where 7 million residents lack high-speed internet connection. But distributing that money appropriately and efficiently is a formidable challenge, especially for a relatively new state office still trying to build up a staff that will oversee the work. The internet providers say they are simultaneously hopeful and skeptical about whether the incoming federal dollars will be enough to connect the most underserved Texans. Historically, other federal rural broadband funding programs have seen limited success because many companies who committed to providing broadband went into default after radically underestimating the cost to deploy broadband infrastructure in far-flung regions. Rural communities that have the greatest needs worry they will continue to be left behind. We want to make sure that there's a reasonable allocation of these dollars, said Rusty Moore, COO of Big Bend Telephone Company in Alpine. We've been very vocal about where the challenges are. In 2021, President Joe Biden signed the Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act, which included $42.5 billion earmarked for the Broadband Equity Access and Deployment Program. The funds aim to connect more than 8.5 million households and small businesses nationwide, including 2.5 million households in Texas. Last summer, the Biden administration announced the state allocations for the program, with Texas receiving the largest portion of the funds. Texas's Broadband Development Office submitted its initial funding proposals in December, identifying areas of the state that are eligible for funding as well as a comprehensive plan to award sub-grantees. Lawmakers created this state agency in 2021. It has filled about 60% of its positions, Director Greg Conte said this month. As the office awaits approval on its proposals to the National Telecommunications and Information Administration, rural communities are already concerned about a federal requirement that excludes from the BEAD program locations already receiving other government funding. In a letter obtained by the Tribune that will be sent, the Federal Communications Commission, a national coalition including broadband providers and nonprofit organizations, noted that some recipients nationwide of previous grant programs have failed to use their allocations to build out broadband networks. Texas Rural Funders, a nonprofit dedicated to rural philanthropy, took the lead in collecting signatures from Texans. They said the FCC should allow those recipients to relinquish their awards without penalty so those regions can become for bead dollars. The Commission should not permit these underserved rural communities to face this type of double whammy and be left behind once again. The letter, which had been signed by 32 organizations, states, Kelty Garby, executive director of Texas Rural Funders, pointed to the $20.4 billion Rural Digital Opportunity Fund. Of the $9.2 billion awarded through phase one of the project, over $2.8 billion has gone into default. The FCC has proposed fines against at least 95 of the program applicants, according to an FCC filing, including some in Texas. The commission was widely criticized for not properly screening internet service providers. The majority of defaults came from three internet providers who could not provide the level of service they promised. Garby said additional providers who have already been awarded money have yet to make good on their promise to develop broadband networks. It is not clear when the remaining funds from the RDOF program will be awarded or what will happen to defaulted bids. There are providers intentionally sitting on a service area to try to keep a competitor out, Garby said, and others trying to make money off of the interest from the grant money. In West Texas, Rusty Moore saw that happen firsthand. His company lost a bid to a wireless carrier who ended up defaulting on their grant and not providing internet service. That's disappointing for the citizens of those areas, Moore said. We would have been done by now. Providers worry that without a rigorous screening process, the same companies who previously defaulted would again win broadband funding, but then not implement a project. According to Texas's draft proposal to NTIA, the primary criteria for selecting a service provider to be a subgrantee of the federal funds is their estimated cost per location as well as how affordable their internet service will be for customers. Providers that can deploy broadband at a lower cost are favored. Other criteria, such as the sustainability of the project and demonstrated readiness, are not given as much weight, though they are still considered. I understand the competitive part of this, but when we're talking about this much public money, I'm not sure this is the way to go, said Jennifer Prather, CEO of TotalCom Communications, LLC, a rural broadband and telecommunications company headquartered in De Leon. Almost no points are awarded for the history of providing service. You're opening the door to a lot of hopes and dreams and not a lot of proof. Conte of the Broadband Development Office said that as part of the subgrantee selection process, his office will make sure applicants meet minimum qualifications for financial, managerial, technical, and operational capabilities. He said the office will also include accountability measures to ensure subgrantees follow through on their commitments. Two examples of that are requiring funds to be reimbursed if projects aren't completed and mandating progress reports. Still, some providers remain skeptical. Texas was awarded $363.8 million in broadband funding through the American Rescue Plan Act in 2021. Applicants to the program said they are frustrated with how slow the rollout has been. The state's broadband office initially said that it would announce who is receiving those funds in the summer or fall of 2023, but applicants have yet to hear back. The sense of frustration is extremely high right now because they are sitting on a lot of money, said Carol Faulkner, president of Digital Fields, a Texas-based company that specializes in communications infrastructure. There's not a lot of confidence in what the Broadband Development Office is doing. Faulkner added that issues with the state's broadband map contributed to rural residents' dissatisfaction. In a previous version of the map, which shows regions not connected to the internet, the vast majority of Texans appeared to already have access to broadband and would therefore be ineligible for funding. Many residents and community organizations challenged the map, saying they did not actually have internet access. The broadband office has since ended its contract with mapping vendor Lightbox and will instead align their map with the federal map, which has also gone through a challenge process. In addition to the federal dollars, Texas voters last November approved the creation of the Texas Broadband Infrastructure Fund, which will provide about $1.5 billion to bolster efforts to expand internet availability. It is the biggest state investment in broadband development to date. Conte said that money will likely be used in part to assist internet providers with meeting federal requirements that they match at least 25% of the total program awards. The office is currently seeking a vendor who will help them manage the administrative task of distributing broadband dollars. Obituaries. Ray Pace. Lieutenant Colonel Ray T. Pace, USMC, retired, known to his family and friends as Tom, was born December 8, 1937, in Los Angeles. He died on February 11th in Nederland, Texas, surrounded by three children and his wife of 62 years, Hazel Ray Tripp Pace. The funeral will be held on Saturday, February 17th at 3 p.m. at Connection Christian Church, 2421 Tanglewood Lane, Odessa. There will be a graveside service immediately following. Monsignor James P. Bridges. Monsignor James Bridges of Midland passed away on Thursday, February 8th. A rosary will be recited at 7 p.m. Thursday, February 15th at St. Stephen's Catholic Church. Mass will be at 10 a.m. Friday, February 16th at St. Stephen's Catholic Church. Monsignor James Bridges and his twin sister were born in Plainview, August the 15th, 1929, raised in La Mesa. Albert Richard Britz. Albert Richard Britz, 71, of Odessa, passed away on Tuesday, January 9th. The family will be having a private memorial service. Albert Richard Britz was born on April 29th, 1952, in El Paso. Richard Wesley Galloway. Richard Wesley Galloway, 75, died Thursday, February 8th in Odessa. Services are pending with American Heritage Cemetery Funeral Home Crematory of Midland. Brenda Gray Hurt. Brenda Gray Hurt, 70, of Odessa, died Sunday, February 9th, in Lubbock. Memorial service will be held at 3 p.m. February 16th at Sunset Memorial Funeral Home. Reverend Dr. Jimmy Braswell is officiating. Arrangements are by Sunset Memorial Gardens and Funeral Home of Odessa. Jace Michael Lackey. Jace Michael Lackey, 24, died Friday, February 2nd in Midland. Services are pending with American Heritage Cemetery Funeral Home Crematory of Midland. Juana Navarrete. Juana Navarrete, 83, of Jal, died Friday, February 9th in Jal. Chapel service was held at 2 p.m. February 13th, a family service funeral chapel. Burial followed at Jal Cemetery, Ray Ochoa officiating. Janet May Norby. No services have been scheduled for Janet May Williams Norby, 69, of Odessa, who died Friday, February 9th in Odessa. Arrangements are by Acres West Funeral Chapel of Odessa. David Shane Posser. David Shane Posser, 51, died Saturday, February 3rd in Midland. Services are pending with American Heritage Cemetery Funeral Home Crematory of Midland. Bill Lee Quillen. Bill Lee Quillen, 84, of San Angelo, passed away February 12th. Bill was born on May 24th, 1939, in Houston. A visitation will be held on Friday, February 16th, from 5 to 7 p.m. at Harper Funeral Home. A memorial service will be held Saturday, February 17th at 2 p.m. at First Presbyterian Church of San Angelo. Charles Royce Shepherd. Charles Royce Shepherd, 88, of Crane, passed away on February 8th. Charles was born March 10th, 1935. Visitation was held Monday, February 12th at Schaffer Nichols Funeral Home from 6 to 8. Funeral service was held February 13th at 2 p.m. at First Baptist Church of Crane. Nicole Trujillo. Nicole Trujillo, 83, died Tuesday, January 30th in Midland. Services are pending with American Heritage Cemetery Funeral Home Crematory of Midland. Sean Wallace, born 1927, died 1924. Sean Wallace, 51, died Friday, February 2nd in Odessa. Services are pending with American Heritage Cemetery Funeral Home Crematory of Midland. Kinsey Tessa Renee White. Kinley Tessa Renee White, 17, of Lubbock, lost her battle with osteosarcoma on January 27th. She was born August 23rd, 2006. The family would like to thank everyone around the country who had included Kinley and all their family in your prayers. OPD investigating phone theft. The Odessa Police Department is investigating a theft that occurred January 19th at the Walmart located at 4210 North JBS. According to an OPD news release, the victim reported that she accidentally left her $1,200 iPhone on the checkout counter. Investigation revealed that the phone was later picked up by an unknown male subject who was occupying a white Cadillac with a sunroof. Anyone who recognizes the suspect shown in the surveillance footage is encouraged to contact Detective N. Troglin at 432-284-2012 or Odessa Crime Stoppers at 432-333-TIPS and reference case number 24000800.
Mayo Clinic Minute. The importance of precise lymphoma diagnosis. Dr. Elisa Rimza is a pathologist, director of the Mayo Clinic Molecular Diagnostic Laboratory, and researcher with the Mayo Clinic Comprehensive Cancer Center. Her research specializes in lymphoma, with a focus on developing tests for accurate patient diagnoses and assessing disease aggressiveness. Rimza has made significant advances in this field of research. She says having a precise diagnosis allows physicians to provide patients with the best possible treatment. Quote, my lab focuses on lymphoma, which is a group of diseases and cancers that arise from the lymphatic systems, end quote, says Rimza. Quote, we specialize in developing new tests to make sure we can get the most accurate diagnosis for the patient and also figure out whether their disease is likely to be more or less aggressive, end quote, she says. Quote, we've been working with an interesting platform or technology platform, which actually is able to use the tissue that is most commonly available from patient biopsies when a biopsy is taken out. It's put in formaldehyde and then in paraffin wax, end quote, she says. Quote, we've been using a technology that actually is able to work with that tissue and get good information about genes and expression, end quote. Quote, it's absolutely important that the patient has the most accurate diagnosis as possible. And what we're doing is going through the most common types of lymphomas and trying to build a series of assays that will answer several different diagnostic questions, end quote, says Risma. California could legalize psychedelic therapy. Sacramento, California. A pair of California lawmakers introduced a bipartisan bill on Tuesday to allow people 21 and older to consume psychedelic mushrooms under professional supervision as part of an agenda to tackle the state's mental health and substance use crises. It comes after Democratic Governor Gavin Newsom last year vetoed legislation that would have decriminalized the possession and personal use of several plant-based hallucinogens, including psychedelic mushrooms. It was the first time the proposal by Democratic Senator Scott Wiener made it through the legislature after years of stalling. In his veto message, Newsom, who championed legalizing cannabis in 2016, asked lawmakers to work on therapeutic guidelines and regulations. Now Wiener has teamed up with Republican Assemblymember Marie Waldron on a proposal to allow participants to consume psilocybin, the hallucinogenic component in what's known as psychedelic mushrooms, under the supervision of a licensed therapist. The bill also would include dimethyltryptamine, DMT, MDMA, and mescaline. Colorado and Oregon have already decriminalized psychedelic mushrooms and established regulated systems for therapeutic use of the substances. In California, San Francisco, Oakland, and Santa Cruz have effectively decriminalized possession of psychedelic mushrooms, meaning a person cannot be arrested or prosecuted for possessing limited amounts of plant-based hallucinogens. Quote, we know that Californians are struggling with mental health and addiction challenges, and we know that psychedelics, particularly when combined with therapeutic support, can be a powerful tool to help people get their health back, end quote, Wiener said at a Monday news briefing. Quote, we know that California veterans and first responders have particularly benefited from these substances, and we know that many more people can as well, end quote. Waldron, who introduced a different bill to study the use of psychedelic therapy, said the bipartisan bill aligns with Newsom's vision by providing safeguards around psychedelic therapy. A person would have to go through a comprehensive screening to determine if they're fit to consume hallucinogens for therapy and engage in follow-up assessments. The bill also would shift the state's response to mental health crisis away from criminalization and punishment, Waldron said. California already has, quote, a massive network, end quote, of underground therapists who provide psychedelic therapy, Wiener said. He added the bill would, quote, bring them above ground, end quote, through a new state licensing board that regulates the services. The legislation does not allow for personal possession and use. That means clients can't buy the substance to go. The drugs would still be illegal under federal law. Wiener said he doesn't want to wait on actions from the federal government and that state lawmakers could authorize such regulated psychedelic use, similar to previous efforts to legalize therapeutic use of cannabis to treat cancers or HIV. Touted as a mind-bending drug in the 1960s, psychedelic mushrooms have been used in religious or spiritual practices in some cultures for centuries and possibly thousands of years. Some researchers believe psilocybin and other drugs show promise in treating depression, anxiety, and post-traumatic stress disorder. The Food and Drug Administration in 2018 designated psilocybin a, quote, breakthrough therapy, end quote, and published draft guidance last year for researchers designing clinical trials for psychedelic drugs. The bill is sponsored by Heroic Hearts Project, a nonprofit working with veterans to overcome trauma. Proponents of the bill anticipate it would take 18 to 24 months to implement the program if the bill becomes law. The bill would also create an education program focused on harm reduction and the potential adverse effects of psychedelics.
Here was the Dear Abby column that appeared in the Midland Reporter-Telegram on Thursday, February 15th. Boy's poor eating habits frustrate his grandparent. Dear Abby, I have a close relationship with my grandchildren and their parents. My 12-year-old grandson eats nothing except fast food and refuses everything else. His parents allow it and even have food delivered for him. His 8-year-old sister watches closely and is starting to head in the same direction. What they do at home is one thing, but it's a problem for me when they visit, especially for 3 or 4 days. Help! Signed, Frustrated Cook. Dear Cook, have the child's parents considered that their son may have an eating disorder? If they haven't, it may be time for them to discuss his eating habits with his pediatrician. Although some children may be spoiled and catered to, others may need medical or psychological intervention. Because this presents a problem for you when your grandchildren visit, rather than waste the food they refuse to eat, have their parents send their food with them. Dear Abby, I am 4'11" and wear a size 5 shoe. Yesterday, my husband and I went to a department store to buy a pair of slippers for him that were on sale. The slippers were kept where socks are sold, not in the shoe section, so there was no chair for him to sit on to try them on like there is in the shoe section. He has balance issues. I then went to check out shoes for myself in the shoe section, and guess what? The rack was so high I couldn't reach the box, let alone see what was in them. This has happened to me several times. Short people wear small-size shoes, and, as you can guess, the largest size was on the bottom. I'm sure shoppers who wear large sizes don't appreciate having to drop to the floor to get their shoes. Is anyone thinking out there? It's just common sense. What say you? Signed, Small Gal in Pennsylvania. Dear Gal, speaking as another short person, 5'2.5" and shrinking, I feel your pain and agree with your logic. What I say is this: talk about this with the store manager and perhaps they will rethink how the shoes are displayed. It's worth a try. Dear Abby, in his last days, my stepfather asked that I not tell my brothers, my mom, his ex, and other family members about his cancer. I struggled with it for months. After his passing, the family found out I had known and hadn't told them, and they blamed me for not telling them. I told them he didn't want them to know. They said he didn't mean it. Oh, yes, he did. The problem with them is they are drama-filled, which is why even I usually don't deal with them. They called me names, but I was only doing what he specifically asked me to do. How do I deal with this? Signed, Sad Stepson in Washington. Dear Stepson, your brothers appear to be blaming you because they weren't as close to their stepfather as they might have been. I will assume that you see them infrequently. If you must see them and the subject comes up, repeat this mantra. Dad asked me not to say anything. If he wanted you to have that information, he would have told you. And that includes your mother.
Thank you for joining us for the readings of the Midland Reporter-Telegram and the Odessa American. This is the Recording Library of West Texas, enriching the lives of individuals with physical, visual, and learning disabilities since 1963. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand with your computer or favorite mobile device at recordinglibrary.org.